Welcome to the 8th episode of Redefine Politics. I'm Benny, and joining me today is Donna Shalala, who served as Bill Clinton's Health and Human Service Secretary, and also a Florida Congresswoman. In this episode, she talks about her experience in government, but also her perspectives on the current health crisis of COVID-19. And I hope that you enjoy this episode as much as I did, as her insights were just incredible and so amazing to learn about. So here's our conversation. Hi, Secretary Shalala.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Good.
Fantastic. Before I get started, can I record this conversation just so
sure.
I can...
Sure.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. How was your week? I know that you were traveling the past week.
No, I was traveling all week. Denver, Washington, Cleveland.
Lots of places. Cool. Yeah. Do you want to introduce yourself a little bit, where you're from, and also what your childhood was like?
Well, I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. My parents were working class. My father owned a small grocery store. My mother was a teacher. Eventually, she went to law school. She was also a nationally ranked tennis player, which was interesting for someone that grew up without a lot of money. But in those days, you could play competitive tennis without a lot of resources. I have a twin sister, and I went to public schools in Cleveland, Ohio, did pretty well, and went on to a women's college in Southern Ohio, Western College for Women, which is now part of Miami of Ohio. And from there, I was always interested in journalism. I worked for the Cleveland Press, the Scripps Howard newspaper during the summers. When I was a senior in college, I decided, you know, that I really wanted an adventure in. My family sort of wanted me to go to law school or to get a professional degree. So I applied to law schools and to master's programs, but I also applied to the Peace Corps. And I laid all my acceptances out of my bed. I remember this in college, my senior year, and said, which would be the best adventure? And it was clearly the Peace Corps. So I went off to the Peace Corps in Iran, which was probably a defining experience in my life. Made me a world citizen. I had majored in history as an undergraduate. I thought Iran would be a real adventure. It certainly was. There's no question about it. I lived in a mud village in southern Iran. We built an agricultural college for the government, taught students there, mostly English, traveled the Middle East and Asia and Europe on my way home and during the time I was a Peace Corps volunteer. Then came back to graduate school, really because I was following friends. They weren't very interested and left, and I stayed on and got a PhD. But I still wanted to be a journalist. I always wanted to be a journalist. So I applied to the Post, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. They didn't have jobs. My major professor said, finish your PhD. Get an academic job. And I wanted to go to New York, so I got an academic job. The rest is really history. I got my tenure at Columbia in politics and went on from there into government. My first tour of duty, actually my second, if you count the Peace Corps, in the Carter administration at HUD as the Assistant Secretary for Policy. Then back to New York to be president of Hunter College, then on to the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin, then back to government as the Secretary of Health and Human Services, and then to Miami. Ran for office a couple of years ago, won a congressional seat, and then lost it 2 years later in a landslide in Florida, a Republican landslide in Florida. And I've been teaching ever since.
I'm actually a student journalist as well. I got involved, I think, in middle school. Obviously, not as like long as you, but like I really love journalism. I think I grew up watching a lot of TV, like every single morning before I go to school. I just watched CBS This Morning, and I've been watching it for such a long time. And I decided, okay, I want to get involved in student journalism as well because there's so many important stories to tell in like my small school, middle school, and high school community. So I've been getting involved in that the past.
You know, telling stories is what good journalism is about. telling stories about people's lives. Politics is really about understanding people's lives. And journalism is a very good training. I was editor of my junior high school newspaper, my high school newspaper, and my college newspaper. And it also teaches you how to write succinctly.
Yes, it does. I'm going to be a senior, so.
And you're applying to colleges.
Yes. Yes. So many colleges, too many. Not ready for it, but like I still got a couple of months, so getting started early so I don't have to stress when seniors get scary.
You know, it's very difficult for young people their senior year in terms of applying for colleges. Everybody's under stress. The truth is you can't make a mistake. You can cast your net widely. No matter where you go, you're going to be successful. Most young people, when I look at their array of colleges they've been accepted at, I say you can't make a mistake. Go to the one where you look like you'll be comfortable. Look at the library, who's sitting around. Trust your gut. Forget about overanalyzing it.
Definitely, yeah. Thanks. I'll keep that in mind, definitely. Getting involved in government is such a big undertaking and responsibility. So I wanted to get to know about how did you get first involved? What motivated you to want to get involved in public service?
You know, initially it was the Peace Corps, and it was John Kennedy who encouraged young Americans to go into the Peace Corps and to make contributions and to be in public service. So initially it was that. After that, I was just deeply interested in politics and policy. And so I've had a career basically being an academic, but going in and out of government. For young people today, I urge them to get internships working for members of Congress, or for state legislators or for mayors, to get a feel for what's going on and to work on campaigns. It's less important what your ideology is than it is getting the experience of understanding the political process. You have to respect people that run in politics. It's not an easy profession.
You advise people wanted to get involved in running for office that if you don't like being attacked, don't run. You got to have a backbone in this business.
You do. But you also have to have a passion for it. The passion helps you have a backbone. You have to care deeply about what you're doing and about improving people's lives.
Was that what motivated you throughout your decades of service?
I wanted to make a difference. I just wanted to make a difference. So I did it in a variety of different ways. I did it in higher education. I did it in the classroom. And I did it in government. Mm-hmm. I basically wanted to improve people's lives around the world.
As secretary, you worked really hard to promote healthcare insurance. Why did that mean so much to you as an individual?
I think good politicians and leaders have to anticipate the future. That means you have to invest in the future. And that means investing in young people, making sure they're healthy and wealthy enough so that they can fulfill their dreams. As someone once said, you know, opportunity isn't evenly evenly spread in this country, but talent is. And the question is, how can we tap into that talent and give everybody that's willing to work hard an opportunity? And that's basically what my life has been about.
I wanted to also ask you a little bit about some current events. As Health and Human Service Secretary, you've been very involved in especially the health of our country. Obviously, we've got COVID-19 right now. So what is your perspective on the current state of what's happening? And what is something that you did during your time as secretary that has played and continue to play as an important part of our government's attempt to stop the virus from affecting more individuals?
Well, the early research that allowed us to find the COVID vaccine was done as a result of us doubling the budget of the National Institutes of Health, strengthening their ability to develop vaccines. The Vaccine Institute at the NIH was not just for AIDS in the 90s, but it was for all vaccines. And we would not have been able to move rapidly on the COVID vaccine without that particular investment. I also worked hard to make sure that vaccines were nonpartisan and that scientists rather than politicians talked about infectious diseases and about what we needed to do. I think we've just totally created a mess in our country where we've politicized the vaccine and the scientists. And for people like Tony Fauci, who has been a world leader, international leader, to be dragged through the mud by politicians is outrageous. But I also think that we should have, from the beginning, let the scientists be our spokespeople, not the politicians. I don't care what the president of the United States says about COVID or any other infectious disease. I want to know what Tony Fauci, with the head of CDC, what those people say that we should be doing. The truth is, we have to educate as we go along. We have extended life in this country through the simplest public health approaches. Washing hands, sanitation, building codes, childhood vaccines, all of these, and adult vaccines. People vaccinate their children without hesitation, and now they're afraid to take a vaccine themselves. Their kids ought to be prodding them.
Yeah, you brought up Dr. Fauci. I know that you are friends with him, so do you want to talk a little about your relationship with him and how you first met him?
Well, Tony Fauci is one of the most extraordinary human beings I've ever met. I met him when I became, when I first went on the board of the National Institutes of Health before I became secretary. 5 years before, I went on the board, the director's council of the National Institutes of Health, and I met him then. So I've known him for a very, very long time. And I think the world of him. I trust him implicitly. He's not political. He says what he says is based on the science and on his good judgment as a scientist physician. I even named my dog for him, Fauci.
Nice. How many dogs do you have?
One little 9-pound COVID dog. That is, he was found running around the streets in Miami. And a rescue group called me and said, hey, we know your dog died a few years ago. How would you like a little dog? I'd never had a little dog, but he's cute as a button. He's a doggy daycare day.
Oh, cool. Doggy daycares. Yes, those are fun. You're talking about the vaccine, and there's been lots of politicization, as you talked about, and to people who have fears, what would you say to encourage them and to alleviate their fears?
Well, first of all, millions of people have gotten the vaccine without getting sick. A few people have gotten sick that have the vaccine, but not very sick. The people that are now in our hospitals have not gotten vaccinated. And this is not about us. This is about protecting members of our family, little kids in our family who can't get vaccinated. It's about protecting our friends and neighbors. So we shouldn't be thinking about ourselves or being afraid for ourselves. We should be thinking about our friends and neighbors and the members of our family to protect them. And I think it's very important that people think that way. The other thing is flu shots. Millions of Americans have gotten flu shots without getting sick. Even if you do get a little sick, you won't die. But you're taking a very big risk if you don't get the vaccine. But more importantly, you're taking a risk for your friends and family. All the little babies that can't possibly get vaccines, that's who we're trying to protect. In the same way that I talked to you about anticipating the future, we're trying to protect the next generation. It's not a big sacrifice. Millions and millions of people all over the world have taken these vaccines without anything serious happening to them.
I know that reopening has started, and there has been rises in COVID cases, and also the Delta variant is very contagious. So what is your perspective on that? Should masks be required for people with vaccines?
Oh, I think they have to be, because we're protecting ourselves against people who haven't been vaccinated. And we're just protecting our friends and neighbors again, and our fellow students. So we're gonna have to wear masks for a long time. It's not that we like it. It's just that it's necessary to protect ourselves and our families. It's also necessary for those of us that are eligible to get the vaccinations, which is the other way we protect people. The reason you're gonna have to wear a mask to school is because someone has not gotten vaccinated. If we got everybody vaccinated, we wouldn't have to fool around with masks.
After your time serving as secretary, you were awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Bush, and that you're really close friends with him. So how did that come to be?
Well, he asked me to co-chair with Senator Bob Dole, the Republican, a commission on the healthcare for wounded warriors that were coming back. And we did that. But I've known President Bush since he was governor of Texas. And so he wanted a bipartisan commission. So he appointed me as the Democrat and Bob Dole as the Republican. And that resulted in, but the Presidential Medal of Freedom is awarded for your entire career. But that was the cherry on the cake.
I don't know that much about commissions. So can you talk a little bit about—
Yeah, commissions are where you get, where you put together prominent people to solve a problem. And our problem was that young people were coming back from our wars, Afghanistan and Iraq in particular, with severe illnesses. In any other generation, they would have died. But our healthcare in the field got so good that we brought them back and helped them to live, but providing them with the level of services they needed for the rest of their lives was a big challenge. They might live in northern Wisconsin and the local VA was in Milwaukee. So we had to figure out a way to put together teams of physicians and nurses in their own communities to provide them with the kind of healthcare they needed so they could stay in their own neighborhoods, in their own homes. And we had to support their families at the same time.
How are you able to do that? And what specifically did you do to—
We developed a series of legislation that invested in their lives and passed it in the Congress.
Also, talking about politics, you ran and you were in Congress 2 years ago, right?
Yeah.
And you said, I think that if we had run against a reasonable Republican in 2020, we would have gotten beaten. Why do you think that was?
Well, I think that President Trump spent an enormous amount of time in South Florida. And I think he convinced the Latin American and the Cuban population that Democrats were all socialists and communists. And I think that we didn't effectively counter that, even though lots of people do, number one. Number two is the Republicans really did registration better than we did. They registered more, they turned the district into a Republican district by registering people and spending millions of dollars getting their voters registered and out to vote. And we simply got beat by that.
I know that Donald Trump has promoted in the past 4 years a lot about him helping the Latin American and specifically the Cuban American population and representing Miami, which is heavily Cuban and Latino. Do you think that he had helped that community a lot?
No, I don't think he did anything for them. I think he gave them a lot of rhetoric. I think the situation in Cuba got worse, not better, and the same thing for Venezuela under the Trump administration. But he talked a good game.
And the Democratic Party has not?
It's beginning to, as a party.
Can you describe how the change in your district, specifically because of COVID, affected how you had to campaign differently?
Well, first of all, we couldn't campaign door to door the way we usually did. So the grassroots campaigning was out. Even though the Republicans did a lot more than we did, they didn't pay any attention to COVID. They still went door to door. Second, our town meetings were all by Zoom. Even though we had big turnouts for our town meetings, they were all online. And third, there were a lot of races around the country, so raising money was not easy. Even though I had a lot of money for my campaign, it was not easy. But mostly, we were out, voted by the Republicans. They turned out 85% of their vote. We turned out 75% of our vote. So they really pulled their voters, and it made a difference. And add Donald Trump to that, where he's popular among the Latino community, the Hispanic community in South Florida.
when you mean town halls, so you hosted different Zoom meetings where your constituents can come and ask you questions?
Yes, and I got experts on COVID in particular and on small business and on all the issues that were of concern to them.
How many times did Donald Trump visit your district?
Oh my God. He was here every 2 months. He or a member of his cabinet or a prominent Republican were here all the time. It was a nightmare.
What strategies do you think that Biden can do to help better the Democrats' chances?
He's got to help on Cuba, obviously. He's taking a strong stand on Cuba and Venezuela. He's got to spend some time down here, which would be helpful. His cabinet is already coming down, but we have to do the grassroots work. We have to register voters, and then we have to turn our voters out. And we'll have a big election next year for the Senate as well as for governor, so that turning out our voters will be very important. We cannot win Florida without winning downstate, and that is Miami-Dade County, Broward, and Palm Beach.
Do you plan on running for any of those offices anytime soon?
You know, we're going to have some redistricting, so I'm going to take a look at the district and see if it's viable for someone like me.
But no governor, no senator yet?
No.
No, okay, cool. I also wanted to learn a little bit more about your time in Congress. You said that 50% of your bills that you worked on were bipartisan. So what was your experience in the 2 years that you were in the House?
I think bipartisan is possible. Sometimes on the big issues, they get very politicized and you get locked in terms of a party. But I think bipartisan is possible. I think that you've got to reach across the aisle. You've got to identify the issues. We were able to get our budget through in a bipartisan manner. We were able to get the Defense Authorization Act through. We worked on the vaping bill, gun safety. I mean, a lot of these attracted Republican votes.
That's good. Joe Biden, he considers himself a moderate and someone who works across the aisle. I've talked to Republican senators from when he was a senator, and they said that he's liberal. So what's your perspective on that? Do you agree or
disagree? No, I think he has a long history of bipartisanship, and he cares a lot about it. He cares a lot about reaching across the aisle. You know, on environmental issues, I think there's bipartisan support. We were able to get the entire Florida delegation, most of whom are Republicans, to vote against offshore drilling, for example, to vote for funding the Everglades restoration. So we were very successful to fund humanitarian aid for Venezuela and other restraints on the communist Venezuelan government. So it is possible to pull people together.
And the way to do that is?
You reach across the aisle, you talk to people, you develop relationships, you find out what they're interested in for their district.
Was there anyone particular during your time in Congress who you developed a relationship in which you reached across and then you were able to work something through and became close because you guys were willing to, you know, set aside your differences and work together?
Yeah, I think Representative Roe, who's a doctor, the doctors in Congress, we were able to get a bill on surprise billing. Senator Cassidy from Louisiana, who's a conservative Republican, we all worked together to get a decent bill to eliminate surprise billing. That is when someone goes into a hospital and suddenly they find out their radiologist is not covered by their insurance plan. The rest of their costs are, but not their radiologist. Or they go into an emergency room and find out that the neurologist who they invited in to consult is not covered. So we eliminated all of that. That was bipartisan.
In terms of looking forward, how do you suggest common Americans who disagree with one another to work together and work past the differences and be members who support one another?
Well, I think that they've got to get to know each other. They've got to understand people's lives. Look, I have members of my own family who are Republicans. And we still get together and we figure out what we have in common, which is usually kids, among other things. But we've got some policy stuff in common. No one wants their kid to start vaping.
Mm-hmm, definitely, yes.
Everybody wants everybody to have good health insurance. How you get there is what we debate.
Yeah. Shifting to academia, do you want to talk a little bit about your experience in that? And I know that you were in so many universities. I think you served as the head of three. So what was like the difference between each of these, and what's the responsibilities of a president of a university compared to being a professor?
Well, the president is obviously the leader. Hunter College in New York was a big urban commuter institution. University of Wisconsin was one of the great research universities in the world. The University of Miami is a private institution, but has a huge medical complex as part of it. It's an important research institution with a great undergraduate program. So these things are all important institutions, but they were all very different.
And in terms of being a professor, what do you specifically teach?
I teach the politics and economics of healthcare and the politics and economics of education. So it just depends on the year on what I'm teaching.
Nice.
This year I'm teaching a big undergraduate class on the politics of healthcare.
Has your college been reopening to in-person learning?
Yes, we will reopen. Everybody's going to have to wear a mask in class. And they're urging everybody to get vaccinated. And I think all the faculty and staff must get vaccinated. And we'll have 90 plus students vaccinated, because if they're not vaccinated, they're going to have to get tested on a regular basis.
In terms of your future elections, what do you plan to do differently to help your chances of being reelected if you decide to run?
Oh, it'll all be grassroots. It'll all be getting out to the community and talking to people. That's the most important thing. Anticipating the attacks, but mostly we'll have a lot to run on. Whether it's not just the infrastructure bill, it's all the COVID bills that we've been able to pass that has lifted my community out of poverty.
How long are the campaigns? Do you knock on doors from the morning into the afternoon?
Well, in Miami, you're careful about the heat. So you spend half a day every day campaigning in communities.
Okay.
Because you have to raise money and much of the other part. And then you try to do social media as well as mainstream media.
How early do you have to get started?
Well, it depends on whether you have name recognition. I have tremendous name recognition. I could start when you have to announce in March, and it would make a difference. If no one knows who you are, then you've got to start now.
How much do you expect that you'll have to raise if you decide to run? And how much did you raise?
You have to raise $5 or $6 million for these races in Florida.
Wow. That's crazy.
It's a lot of money. If you think you've got to raise it in small amounts, the maximum anyone can give you combining the primary and the general is $5,400. So it takes a lot of donors to get to millions of dollars.
Yeah, it does. Do you raise all of your money, or the Democratic National Committee, they raise money?
Yeah, it's a Democratic. It's actually the campaign committee for the House of Representatives. It's called the DCCC. No, they didn't help me the last time. They probably would this time.
So they help contribute to some amount, but like individual donors, there's been lots of discussions about PACs and whether people should accept them, especially in the 2020 election, lots of presidential candidates in. So in terms of for House races, does that apply or does that not?
Yeah, you just make a decision. I don't have any problem taking PAC money. I'm going to vote the way I'm going to vote. They know what my positions are and things.
What do you hope that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris can promote after this infrastructure bill that's going to pass?
Well, they've got a soft infrastructure bill, so-called soft infrastructure bill, that's going to be very critical, that will redefine the role of government for the people. So I hope they're able to pass that. They need to pass a voting rights bill. They need to pass a police reform bill. I mean, they've got a lot of stuff they need to do, and whether they'll get bipartisan support is questionable, but who knows? The American people could put enormous pressure on the Congress to do these things.
Let's end off with something. What advice do you have to give to younger generation who are interested in politics and don't know how to get involved? What would you say?
Well, volunteer for a campaign of any kind. Almost everybody has internships in politics. And that's where you learn a lot, even if you're just doing the most menial jobs. So almost everybody I know who's in elective office started out being an intern and working on a campaign, because that's the way you learn. And there are jobs in Washington on the Hill for your local members, and there are jobs in your local district. And most of the congressional offices hire high school students as well as college students. So there are opportunities, but volunteering for a campaign, I find campaigns fun.
Yes, they are. I have one last question. Have you watched the show Madam Secretary?
Yes, I have. Every version of it. It's pretty dramatic. And she, of course, was Secretary of State, so it's got a more of an international dimension. I think it's pretty accurate. I think it's pretty accurate in terms of the staffing and how the staff interacts with her and dealing with big issues. Doesn't seem to deal with mundane issues. I assume she has deputies for that.
She had her apartment, and then she had like her motorcade and drive there. And like when she walked in the building, people greeted her at the elevator and be like, "Hi, and here's your coffee." Did you have that as well?
No. First of all, I don't let people get me coffee. So I get my own coffee. Second, while I did have marshals as security, it was not a motorcade the way the Secretary of State has. It was just a limousine with security, except when you went abroad, and then you would have some kind of cars in front and in back.
Nice. That's really cool to know. Is there anything else that you would like to say?
I just think people ought to follow their passions. If you're really interested in politics, then get into politics. Get to know what campaigns are about. Get to work in someone's office, whether it's a state legislature or a mayor's office or a congressional office or a Senate office. All of them have internship programs. And all of them, you'll learn a lot. But yeah. Benny, I think you know a lot. So thank you very much.
No, thank you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Good luck to you.
Yes, thank you. Have a great rest of your day.
Well, this concludes this episode of Redefine Politics. If you have any questions or suggestions, please email redefinepolitics@gmail.com. If you enjoyed it, check out previous conversations I've had and follow Redefine Politics on Instagram. Thank you so much for listening, and see you all next time.